the royal treasury to build one grandiose, useless monument after another? The Hagia Sophia was not useless, Justinian, demurred Belisarius. It was, would have been, one of the world's genuine glories. Justinian snorted. I will allow that one exception. No, two. I also codified Roman law. But the rest, he snapped his fingers. That secretary of yours, you know, the foul gossip, what's his name? Procopius? Yes, him. That fawning toad even wrote a book glorifying those preposterous structures. Did you see that? Yes. Michael spoke. I hear you've dispensed with the reptile's services now that you no longer need him to pass false rumors to the enemy. Good riddance. Belisarius chuckled. Yes, I did. I doubt very much that Malwa's spies place any more credence in his claims that Antonina was spending all her time at our estate in Syria holding orgies in my absence. Not after he showed up at the Hippodrome with her force of Syrian grenadiers and smashed the Nikai insurrection, barked Justinian. The former emperor rubbed his eye sockets. Since he's out of work, Belisarius, send him to me. I'll give him a book to write. Just the kind of fawning propaganda he wrote for me in another future. Only it won't be called the buildings. It'll be called the laws. And it will praise to the skies the Grand Justiciar Justinian's magnificent work providing the Roman Empire with the finest legal system in the world. Justinian resumed his seat. Enough of that, he said. There's something else I want to raise. Belisarius, I'm a bit concerned about Antonina's expedition to Egypt. The general cocked an eyebrow. So am I, he exclaimed. She's my wife, you know. I'm not happy at the idea of sending her into battle with only a... Nonsense, snapped the former emperor. The woman'll do fine as far as any battles go. Don't underestimate her, Belisarius. Any woman that small who can slaughter half a dozen street thugs in a knife fight can handle that sorry bastard Ambrose. It's the aftermath I'm worried about. Once she's crushed this mini-rebellion, she'll be moving on. To the naval side of your campaign. What then? He leaned forward, fixing Belisarius with his eyeless gaze. Who's going to keep Egypt under control? You know our plans, Justinian. Hermogenes will assume command of the army of Egypt, and... The former empress snorted. He's a soldier, man. Oh, a damn fine one, to be sure, but soldiers aren't much use when it comes to suppressing the kind of religious fanatics who keep Egypt in a turmoil. He sighed heavily. Trust me, Belisarius, I speak from experience. If you use a soldier to squash a monk, all you create is a martyr. Justinian now turned to face Michael. You're the key here, Michael. We will need your religious authority. And Anthony's, qualified the monk. Justinian waved his hand impatiently. Yes, yes, and the patriarch's help, of course, but you are the key. Why? Demanded Michael. Belisarius replied. Because changing an empire's habits and customs, built through the centuries, will require religious fervor. A popular movement driven by zeal and conviction. I don't disagree with Justinian on that point. He's right. Soldiers just create martyrs. He cleared his throat. And for the other, well, Anthony is as kindly, even saintly a man as I ever hoped to meet. The ideal patriarch. But a wintry smile came to the monk's gaunt face. He's not given to smiting the unrighteous, concluded Michael. The Macedonian shifted position in his chair, much like a hawk sets his talons on a tree limb. I have no such qualms, on the other hand. Rather the contrary, murmured Justinian. The former emperor smiled grimly. He quite approved of Michael of Macedonia. The Stylite monk was a holy man, which Justinian most certainly was not. Yet they shared a certain commonality of spirit. A Thracian peasant and a Macedonian shepherd as youths, simple men, ultimately, and quite savage, each in their own way. Belisarius spoke again, shaking his head. We've already decided to send Michael's monks to Egypt, Justinian. I agree that they'll help. The fact remains, however, that without military force, those monks will just wind up another brawling faction in the streets. Our military forces were already stretched, and now I'll be taking what few troops we can spare to combat the Malwa in Persia. We cannot divert those forces, Justinian, and the imperial treasury is too bare to finance the creation of a new army. Suddenly, images flashed through Belisarius's mind. Ranks of cavalrymen. Their weapons and armor, though well-made, were simple and utilitarian. Over the armor, they wore plain tunics. White tunics bearing red crosses, parading through the main thoroughfare of a great city. Behind them marched foot soldiers, also wearing that simple white tunic emblazoned with a huge red cross. The general burst into laughter. "Thank you, aide." He turned to Michael. "Have you chosen a name for your new religious order?" The Macedonian grimaced.
"Please, Belisarius, I did not create that order. It was created by others."
"Inspired by your teachings," interjected Justinian.
"And practically foisted upon me," the monk scowled. "I have no idea what to do with them. As much as anything else, I offered to send them with Antonina to Egypt because they were demanding some holy task of me, and I couldn't think of anything else to do with them."
The general smiled. For all his incredible, even messianic force of character, Michael of Macedonia was as ill-suited a man as Belisarius had ever met for the executive task of leading a coherent and disciplined religious movement. "Someone must have brought them together," he said. "Organized them. It wasn't more than a month after you began your public sermons in the Forum of Constantine that bands of them began to appear in the streets spreading your message." The Macedonian snorted.
"Three of them, in fact. Their names are Mark of Athens, Zeno Symmachus, and Gaiseric. Zeno is an Egyptian from the Fayum, Gaiseric a Goth. Mark, of course, is Greek. Mark is Orthodox, Zeno is a Monophysite, and Gaiseric is an Arian."
"And they get along?" asked Belisarius lightly. Michael began to smolder, then relaxed.
"Yes, Belisarius, they regard the issue of the Trinity as I do, a decoy of the devils to distract men while Satan does his work."
He smiled.
"Not, mind you, that any room they jointly inhabit isn't occasionally filled with the sound of disputatious voices, and that there is never any anger in it. They are each other's brothers as they are mine."
"And what position do you advance in these occasional disputes?" queried Justinian.
"You know perfectly well my position," snapped Michael.
The former emperor smiled. Justinian adored theological discussion. Other than Theodora's care, it had been the company of Michael and Patriarch Cassian which, more than anything, had enabled him to find his way through the darkness of the soul in the months after his blinding.
"My opinion on the Trinity is orthodox in the same way as Anthony's," stated Michael. "No more plainly put."
He snorted.
"My friend Anthony Cassian is Greek and is therefore not satisfied with simple truth until he can parse it with clever Greek syllogisms and make it dance to dialectical Greek tunes. But I am not Greek. I'm Macedonian. True, we are a related people, but to the Greeks God gave his intellect, and to us he gave his common sense."
Here, a wintry smile.
"This, of course, is why the great Philip of my ancestry lost his patience and decided to subdue the whole fractious lot of quarreling Southron, and why his son, the Macedonian Alexander, conquered the world."
"So the Greeks could inherit it," quipped Justinian. "Place them in charge of the order, then," said Belisarius. "And find women with similar talents. There must be some." Michael stroked his great beard.
"Yes," he said after a moment's thought. "Two in particular come immediately to mind. Julianus Iagrius and Helen of Armenia."
"Julianus Iagrius?" demanded Justinian. "The widow of..." Michael nodded.
"The very same. Not all of my followers are common folk, Justinian. Any number of them are from the nobility, although usually from the equestrian order. Juliana is the only member of the senatorial classes who has responded to my teachings. She's even offered to place her entire fortune at my disposal."
Good Lord, exclaimed Justinian.
She's one of the richest people in the Empire.
Michael glared.
I am well aware of that, thank you, and what am I supposed to do with it? I have lived unarmed since I was a youth, a habit I have no intention of changing.
The sour look on his face made plain the monk's attitude toward wealth. He began to mutter various phrases concerning camels in the eye of a needle. Unkind phrases. Very unkind phrases, in point of fact. Belisarius interrupted the gathering storm. You will use that fortune to buy arms and armor, Michael, and the provisions needed to support your new order.
They will beg for their support, damn them, snapped Michael. Just as I do.
Belisarius shook his head. They will be too busy, much too busy. The general smiled broadly, not crookedly. Yours will be a religious order of a new kind, Michael. A military order. A name flashed through the general's mind.
We will call them the Knights Hospitaller, he said, leaning forward in his chair.
Guided by aid through the labyrinth of future history, Belisarius began to explain. After Michael was gone, hurrying his way out of the great palace, Justinian sighed.
It will not work, Belisarius. Not to be sure, at first.
The former emperor, veteran of intrigue and maneuver, shook his head sadly.
Men are sinners. In time, your new monks will simply become another lot of ambitious schemers grasping for anything in sight.
Image. A magnificent palace. Through its corridors, adorned with expensive statuary and tapestries, moved men in secretive discourse. They wore tunics, still white with a simple red cross. But the tunics were silk now, and the hilts of the swords suspended from their scabbards were encrusted with gems.
True, replied Belisarius.
His voice lost none of its good cheer, but they will not lapse until Malwa is done. After that, Belisarius shrugged. I do not know much, Justinian, of the struggle in the far distant future in which we find ourselves ensnared. But I have always known we were on the right side because our enemies, those who call themselves the new gods, seek human perfection. There is no such thing, and never will be. He rose from his chair. You know that as well as I. Do you really think that your new laws and your judgments will bring paradise on earth, an end to all injustice? Justinian grunted sarcastically. Why do it, then? Demanded Belisarius.
Because it's worth doing, growled Justinian.
The general nodded. God judges us by what we seek, not what we find. Belisarius began to leave. Justinian called him back.
One other thing, Belisarius. Speaking of visions.
The former emperor's face twisted into a half smile. It was a skeptical sort of expression, almost sardonic.
Have you had any further visions about your little protege in India? Is she making Malwa howl yet?
Belisarius returned Justinian's smile with a shake of the head.
Shakuntala?
I don't know. I've certainly had no visions. Aid is not a magician, Justinian. He is no more clairvoyant than you or I. The general smiled himself now. There was nothing sardonic in that expression, though, and it was not in the least bit crooked. I imagine she's doing splendidly. She's probably already got a little army collected around her by now.
Where is she?
Belisarius shrugged. The plan was for her to seek exile in South India. Her grandfather's the king of Kerala. Whether she's there or not, however, I don't know. I've received no word. That's the very reason Irene is accompanying Antonina to Egypt. She'll try to re-establish contact with Shakuntala and Rao through the Ethiopians.
I can't say I'm happy about that, by the way, grumbled Justinian. I didn't oppose the idea at the council, since you seem so set upon it. But Irene's a fiendishly capable spymaster. I'd be a lot happier if she were here at Theodora's side in the capital keeping an eye on traitors.
Skeptically.
Do you really think this little rebellion you took so much time and money to foster is anything but wishful thinking?
Belisarius studied the blind man for a moment before replying. Justinian, for all his brilliance, was ill-equipped by temperament to gauge the power of a popular rebellion. The man thought like an emperor still. Belisarius suspected that he always had, even when he was a peasant himself. I know the girl, Justinian. You don't. For all her youth, she has the potential to be a great ruler. And in Rao, she has one of the finest generals in India. So, grunted Justinian, if the success of your rebellion hinges so completely on two people, the Malwa can take care of that with a couple of assassinations. Belisarius laughed. Assassinate Rao? He's the best assassin in India himself. God help the Malwa who tries to slip a knife into that man's back. He shook his head. As for Shakuntala, she's quite a proficient killer in her own right. Rao trained her from the time she was 7, and she has the best bodyguards in the world. An elite Kushan unit led by a man named Kungus. The skepticism was still evident on the former emperor's face. Belisarius, watching, decided it was hopeless to shake Justinian's attitude. He wasn't there, as I was, to see Shakuntala win the allegiance of the very Kushans who had been assigned by Malwa to be her captors. God, the sheer force in that girl's soul. He turned away, and, struck by a memory, turned back. He did give me a vision once while I was in India. That vision confirmed me in my determination to set Shakuntala free. Justinian cocked his head, listening. Many centuries from now, in the future, in a future, it might be better to say, all of Europe will be under the domination of one of history's greatest generals and conquerors. His name will be Napoleon. He will be defeated in the end, brought down by his own overweening ambition. That defeat will be caused, as much as anything, by a great bleeding wound in Spain. He will conquer Spain, but never rule it. For years, his soldiers will die fighting the Spanish rebellion. The rebels will be aided by a nation which will arise on the island we call Britannia. The Peninsular War, those islanders will call it. And when Napoleon is finally brought down, they will look back upon that war and see in it one of the chief sources of their victory. Still nothing. Skepticism. Belisarius shrugged. Left. Outside in the corridor, Aide spoke in his mind. Not a nice man at all. The facets flashed and spun into a new configuration. Like a kaleidoscope, the colors of Aide's emotion shifted. Sour distaste was replaced by a kind of wry humor. Of course, the Duke of Wellington was not a nice man either. In the room, Justinian remained in his chair. He spent some time pondering the general's last words, but not much. He was far more interested in contemplating a different vision. Somewhere in the midst of the horror which the jewel had shown him, Justinian had caught a glimpse of something which gave him hope. A statue, he had seen, carved by a sculptor of the figure to depict justice. The figure had been blind. In the future, murmured the former emperor, when men wish to praise the quality of justice, they will say that justice is blind. The man who had once been perhaps the most capable emperor in the long history of the Roman Empire, and certainly its most intelligent, rubbed his empty eye sockets. For the first time since his mutilation, the gesture was not simply one of despair and bitterness. Justinian the Great. So more than anything had he wanted to be known for posterity. Perhaps. Theodora at Belisarius's urging had created a position specifically tailored for Justinian. He was now the emperor's grand justiciar. For the first time in centuries, the law of Rome would be codified, interpreted, and enforced by the best man for the task.
Whatever had been his faults as an emperor, there was no one who doubted that Justinian was the finest legal mind in the empire.
Perhaps. There had been Solomon and Solon, after all, and Hammurabi before them. So why not add the name Justinian to that list? It was a shorter list, now that he thought about, than the list of great emperors. Much shorter. Chapter 5
Musiris. Spring, 531 A.D. "Any minute now," whispered the assassin at the window. "I can see the first contingents of her cavalrymen coming around the corner." The leader of the Malwa assassination team came to the window. The lookout stepped aside. Carefully, using only one fingertip, the leader drew the curtain aside a couple of inches. He peered down onto the street below. "Yes," he murmured. He turned and made a gesturing motion with his right hand. The other two assassins in the room came forward, carrying the bombard between them. They moved slowly and laboriously. The bombard was 2 feet long and measured 8 inches across. It was made of wrought iron bars, square in cross-section and an inch thick. The bars were welded together to form a rough barrel about 6 inches in diameter, which was then further strengthened with 4 iron hoops. A thick plate was welded to the back of the bars. The bombard was bolted down to a wooden base, teak reinforced with brass strips, measuring 3 feet by 2 feet. The two men strained under the effort of carrying the device. Part of their careful progress, however, was due to the obstacles in their way. The room was littered with the squalid debris of a poor family's cramped apartment. As they came forward, they maneuvered around the bodies of the family who had once lived there. A man, his wife, her mother, and their 4 children. After killing the family, the assassins had piled the corpses in a corner. But the room was so small that the 7 bodies still took up a full quarter of the floor space. Most of the floor was covered with blood, dried now, but still sticky. A swarm of flies covered the corpses and the bloodstains. One of the assassins wrinkled his nose. "They're already starting to stink," he muttered. "Damn Southwest India and its fucking tropical climate. And we're in the hot season. We should have kept them alive until—" "Shut up," hissed the leader. "What were we going to do, guard them for almost a full day? The baby would have begun squalling anyway." His subordinate lapsed into sullen silence. A few seconds later, he and his companion levered the bombard onto the hastily improvised firing platform which the assassination squad had erected that morning. It was a rickety contraption, simply a mounded-up pile of the pallets and 2 wicker chairs which had been the murdered family's only furniture. But it would suffice. The bombard wasn't a full-sized cannon. It would fire only 1 round, the sack full of drop shot. The recoil would send the bombard hurtling into the far wall out of action. That would be good enough. When she passed through the street below the window of the apartment, the Empress in Exile of Andhra would not be more than 20 yards distant. There was nowhere for her to escape, either, even if the alarm was given at the last moment. The narrow street was hemmed in on both sides by mud-brick tenement buildings identical to the one in which the assassins lay waiting. At that point-blank range, the canister would sweep a large swath of the street clean of life. "Here she comes," whispered the lookout. He was peering through a second window now. Like his leader, he had drawn the curtain aside no more than 1 inch or 2. "Are you certain it is she?" demanded the leader. The lookout had been assigned to the squad because he was one of the few Malwa assassins who had personally seen the rebel empress after her capture at the siege of Amaravati. The girl had aged, of course, since then, but not so much that the lookout wouldn't recognize her. "It must be Shakuntala," he replied. "I can't see her face because she's wearing a veil, but she's small, dark-skinned, wearing imperial regalia. Who else would it be?" The leader scowled. He would have preferred a more positive identification, but— He hissed an unspoken command to the other 2 assassins in the room. The command was unnecessary. They were already loading the gunpowder and the canister round into the bombard. The leader scampered back and sighted along its length. He could only estimate the angle, since the curtain hanging in the window obscured his view of the street below. But the estimate would be good enough. It was not a weapon of finesse and pinpoint accuracy. The leader made a last inspection of the cannon. He couldn't restrain a grimace. The blast and the recoil confined in that small room was almost certain to cause some injuries to the assassins themselves. Hopefully those injuries wouldn't disable any of them, not enough at least to prevent them making their escape into the chaos and confusion after Shakuntala and her immediate entourage were slaughtered. "I wish they'd perfected those new impact fuses they've been working on," muttered one of the assassins. "Then we could have used a real cannon at long range.
This misbegotten... Why not wish she didn't have thousands of Maratha cavalrymen to protect her while you're at it? Snarled the leader. And those fucking Kushan cutthroats. Then we could have just slid a knife into her ribs instead of... She's 50 yards away, hissed the lookout. The first cavalry escorts are already passing below. He plastered himself against the wall, crouching down as far as he could while still being able to peek through the window. The expression on his face, beneath the professional calm, was grim. He was almost certain to be scorched by the exhaust from the cannon blast, and there was also the possibility that a weak weld could result in the cannon blowing up when it was fired. 40 yards. One of the two bombard handlers retreated to a far corner, curling into a ball. The other drew out a lighting device and ignited the slow match. After handing it to the squad leader, he hurried to join his comrade in the corner. The leader crouched next to the bombard's fire hole, ready to set off the charge. 35 yards, announced the lookout by the window. Get ready. The men in the room took a deep breath. They had already decided to fire the bombard when the Empress was 25 yards distant. They knew that Shakuntala's horse would travel less than 5 yards in the time it took for the slow match to ignite the charge. If all went as planned, the sack full of lead pellets would turn the ruler in exile of conquered Andhra into so much mincemeat. The leader held up the slow match, brought it close to the fire hole. 30 yards. The door behind them erupted like a volcano. The first man coming through the door cut the squad leader aside before the assassin had time to do more than flinch. It was a brutal sword strike, not fatal, simply enough to hurl the man away from the cannon. Quick, quick. The assassin screeched with pain. His right arm dangled loose, half severed at the elbow. The slow match fell harmlessly to the floor, hissing in a patch of blood. The lookout at the window had time to recognize the man who killed him before that same sword went into his heart. As agile and skilled as he was, the assassin had no more chance of evading that expert thrust than a tethered goat. In the few seconds that it took him to die, the assassin tried to remember his killer's name. He knew the name, but it wouldn't come. He knew only that he had been slain by the commander of Shakuntala's Kushan bodyguard, the man whom he and his squad simply called Iron Face. One of the assassins huddled in the corner died soon thereafter, hacked into pieces by the three Kushan soldiers who piled into the room after their commander. The commander himself took care of the last Malwa. This one he didn't kill outright. He wanted him for questioning. The Kushan lopped off the man's right hand as it came up holding a blade, then struck him senseless with a blow of the sword's pommel on the forehead. The Kushan commander scanned the room. By now, with another 5 Kushans crowding in, the room was packed like a meat tin. 3 of them had subdued the assassin whose arm the commander had half severed upon bursting through the door. That's enough, he commanded. See to the Empress. No need, Kungus, murmured one of the men. The Kushan soldier had pushed back the curtains in one of the windows. She's on her way here already. Damn the girl, growled Kungus. I told her to stay back. The Kushan commander strode to the window and glared out onto the street below. The Empress, the supposed Empress at the head of the column, was sitting on her horse. The girl was beginning to shake now. A trembling hand came up and removed the veil. She wiped her face, smearing off some of the dye which had darkened her skin. But Kungus was looking elsewhere, farther back along the column of cavalry escort, at the figure of another small girl urging her horse forward. Unlike the Empress, this girl was wearing simple and unadorned clothing, nothing more than a colorfully dyed tunic over pantaloons, the garments of a typical camp follower, a soldier's common-law wife, perhaps. She also was dark-skinned, but her skin tone was natural, and there was not the slightest trace of trembling in her hands. You're going to catch an earful, said the Kushan, standing next to Kungus. She looks angrier than a tigress guarding her cubs, he added cheerfully. Of course, she's a small tigress, for what it's worth. Kungus grunted. For a moment, something that might have been a sigh almost escaped his lips, but only for the briefest instant. Thereafter, the mask closed down. On the street below, the true Empress halted her horse long enough to see to the well-being of her double. Then she dismounted and charged into the entrance of the tenement building.
She was lost from Kungus's sight, but he could hear her stamping up the narrow wooden stairs leading to the rooms on the upper floor. He could also hear her voice. How can such a small girl have such a loud voice, wondered the other Kushan. And how can slippers make such a stamping clatter?
Shut up, Kanishka, growled Kungus.
Kanishka smiled seraphically. The Empress's voice coming from below. Never again, Kungus! Do you hear me? Never again! She burst into the room, her eyes immediately fixed on those of Kungus. Black, hot eyes. Never again! Jijibai might have been killed! Kungus's iron face never wavered, nor did his harsh voice.
So might you, Empress, and you are irreplaceable.
Shakuntala glared at him for a few seconds. Then, recognizing the futility of trying to browbeat the commander of her bodyguard, she glared around the room. When she saw the bodies of the family, she recoiled.
Malwa beasts, she hissed. It's how we spotted them, said Kungus. Our spies saw that this building seemed lifeless, everyone hiding in their rooms, and they smelled the bodies.
He glanced at the bombard. Three of his men were already disarming the weapon. But we only discovered them just in time. It was a well-laid ambush. Their only mistake was killing the family too soon. The baby would have squalled all night, commented Kanishka. Kungus shrugged.
So, it would hardly be the only shrieking infant in a slum.
Shakuntala grimaced. Kungus, in his way, was the hardest man she had ever met. She tore her eyes away from the pitiable sight of the dead family and stared at the assassins.
How many did you keep alive?
Two, replied Kanishka. Better than we hoped.
They'll talk, said Kungus. Not easily, not Malwa assassins, but they'll talk.
They won't know much, said Shakuntala.
Enough. I was right. You'll see.
The Empress stared at Kungus. After a moment, she looked away.
That it would come to this. My own grandfather.
What did you expect?
Came a voice from the door. Shakuntala turned. Dadaji Holkar was standing in the doorway. Her imperial advisor's eyes scanned the room, coming to rest on the piled-up bodies of the dead family.
Malwa, he said softly.
The word was not condemning nor accusatory. It was simply a term of explanation. Self-evident. His eyes returned to Shakuntala.
What did you expect, girl? He repeated. You threaten his kingdom with Malwa's gaze and Malwa's fury. You organize a private army in his largest seaport. You disrupt his streets with riot and tumult.
I did not. It was Malwa provocateurs who stirred up the Carolyn mob against the refugees from Andhra.
Holkar stroked his beard, smiling.
True, but it was your Maratha cavalrymen who sabred the mob and spit them on their lances.
As well they should, came her hot reply. Many of those refugees are Maratha themselves.
Holkar chuckled.
I'm not arguing the merits of the thing, girl. I'm simply pointing out that you have become a major embarrassment to the king of Kerala. That old man is no doting village grandfather, Shakuntala. He is as cold-blooded as any ruler needs to be. With the Malwa Empire now at war with Persia, he thinks he's safe from their ambitions, as long as he can avoid drawing their attention. The last thing he wants is his granddaughter forging a rebellion in the Deccan from a base in his own kingdom.
Holkar stepped into the room, avoiding the bodies which littered the floor. When he came up to the Empress, he placed a gentle hand on her shoulder. He was the only member of her entourage who ever took that liberty. He was the only one who dared.
He is my grandfather, whispered Shakuntala.
Her voice throbbed with pain.
I can remember sitting on his knee when I was a little girl.
She stared out the window, blinking away tears.
I didn't really expect him to help me, but I still didn't think.
He may not have given the orders, Your Majesty, said Kungus. Probably didn't, in fact.
The Kushan commander gestured at the dead assassins.
These are Malwa, not Carolyn.
Shakuntala's black eyes grew hard.
So what? You predicted it yourself, Kungus. A Malwa assassination attempt with the tacit approval of the Carolyn authorities.
She turned away, shaking her shoulders angrily. The viceroy would not have done this on his own. He wouldn't dare.
Why not? He can deny everything.
Again, Kunga's gestured to the dead assassins. Mawa, not Carolyn. Shakuntala stalked toward the door. He would not dare, she repeated. At the door, she cast a final glance at the dead family. This was my grandfather's work, she hissed. I will not forget. A moment later, she was gone. The snapping sounds of her slippered feet going down the stairs came through the door. Dadaji Holkar and Kunkus exchanged a glance. The advisor's expression was rueful. That of Kunkus was sympathetic, insofar as a mask of iron could be said to have an expression. Kanishka had finished tying a tourniquet around the maimed arm of the Malwa assassin leader. He stooped and hauled the man to his feet. The Malwa began to moan. Kanishka silenced him with a savage blow. Glad I'm not her imperial advisor, he muttered. Be like advising a tigress to eat rice. He draped the unconscious assassin over his shoulder and made for the door. Then he said cheerfully, a small tigress, true. For all the good that'll do her grandpa. Within a minute, the Kushans had cleared the bodies from the small apartment, including, at Kungus's command, the bodies of the dead family. They would find a priest to give them the rites. The two dead Malwa assassins would be tossed into a dung heap. After their interrogation, the two still alive would follow them. Kungus and Holker were left alone in the room. That was very close, commented Holker. The statement wasn't a criticism, simply an observation.
There will be another, replied the Kushan commander, and another after that. It's obvious that the Carolan authorities will turn a blind eye to Malwa's spies and assassins coming after her. We must get the Empress to a place of safety, Dadaji, and soon. After today, she will no longer let me use Jijibai as her double.
Kungus's shoulders twitched. Coming from another man, the gesture would have been called a shrug.
I can only protect her for so long here in Muziris.
Hokel broke into a little smile. How about Dayagiri? He asked. Then laughed outright, seeing Kungus's face. For once, just for an instant, there had been an expression on that iron mask. Kungus's eyes had actually widened. In another man, the gesture would have been called a goggle.
Dayagiri, he choked. Are you mad? The place is a Malwa stronghold. It's the largest city in Maharashtra, except for Barakucha. The Malwa have a garrison of...
He broke off. His iron face was back.
You know something, he stated.
Dadaji nodded. We just got word this morning from a courier sent by Rao. Rao believes he can seize Dayagiri. He has apparently managed to infiltrate thousands of his fighters into the city. The garrison is big, but, so he says, and he is a man who knows, sloppy and unprepared. Kungus paced to the window, stared out as if he were gauging the Maratha cavalrymen in the street below, which, as a matter of fact, he was.
Over 3,000 of them we've got now, he mused, with more coming in every day as the word spreads.
You've got more Kushans, too, pointed out Holker.
600, agreed Kungus. Most of them are my own kinfolk who deserted the Malwa once they heard the news of my change of allegiance. But a good third of them are from other clans. Odd, that.
From behind, unobserved by Kungus's sharp eyes, Holker studied the stocky figure standing at the window. His face softened. He'd come to love Kungus, as he had few other men in his life. Belisarius, of course, who had freed him from slavery and breathed new life into his soul. His son, still laboring in captivity somewhere in India along with the rest of Holker's shattered family. Rao, the national hero of the Maratha people whom he had idolized all his life. A brother killed long ago in battle against the Malwa. A few others. But Kungus occupied a special place on that short list. He and Holker were comrades in arms, united in a purpose and welded to a young empress's destiny. Close friends they had become. Two men who would otherwise have been like total strangers, each to the other. Dadaji Holker, the former slave,
low caste by birth and a scribe and scholar by profession. A man whose approach to the world was intrinsically philosophical, but whose soft and kindly soul had a rod of iron at its center. Kungus, the former Malwa mercenary, a Kushan vassal by birth, a soldier by trade. A man whose view of the world was as pragmatic as a tiger's, and whose hard soul was much like his iron-masked face. The one was now an imperial advisor. No, more. Shakuntala had named Holkar the Peshwa of Andhra in exile, the premier of a people laboring in Malwa chains. The other, Kungus, was her chief bodyguard as well as one of her central military leaders. The girl's own soul was like a lodestone for such men. Others had been drawn by that magnet in the months since she set herself up in exile in Muziris. Men like Shaji and Kondev, cavalry commanders, and those who followed them, Maratha horsemen burning to strike a blow at the Malwa. Most were Maratha, of course, like Holkar himself, but not all, by no means. Men had come from all over the subcontinent as soon as they heard that India's most ancient dynasty still lived and roared defiance at the Malwa behemoth. Fighters in the main, or simply men who wanted to be, from many Malwa subject nations. There were Bengali peasants in her small little army taking shape in the refugee camps at Muziris. Not many, but a few. And Biharis and Orissans and Gujaratis. Nor were all of them warriors. Hindu priests had come too. Sadhus like Bindusara, who would hurl their own defiance at the Mahaveda abomination to their faith, and Buddhist monks and Jains, seeking refuge in the shelter which the Satavahana dynasty had always given their own creeds. In the few months since she had arrived in Muziris, Shakuntala's court in exile had become something of a small splendor, modest, measured by formal standards, luminous, measured by its quality. But of all those men who had come, Holkar treasured one sort above all others. Malwa power rested on four pillars. First and foremost, their monopoly of gunpowder and their Yetai barbarians. Holkar intended to steal the first, or get it from the Romans. The other, death to the Yetai. Then there were the two other pillars. The soldiers who formed the Malwa army's true elite. The Rajputs and the Kushans. No Rajputs had come. Holkar would have been astonished if they had. The Rajputs had sworn allegiance to the Malwa Empire, and they were a people who held their honor sacred. Still, he had hopes. Perhaps someday, what man can know. But the Kushans, that was a different matter. A steadfast folk, the Kushans, but they had none of Rajputana's exaggerated concept of honor and loyalty. The Kushans had been a great people themselves in their day, conquerors and rulers of Central Asia and Northern India. But that day was long gone. Persia had conquered half their empire, and the other half had been overrun by the Yetai. For centuries now, the Kushans had been mere vassals under the thumb of others, valued for their military skills, but otherwise treated with disdain. Their loyalty to Malwa, Dadaji had often thought, was much like Kungus's face. To the outer world, iron, but still a mask when all was said and done. Kungus's voice interrupted his little reverie. "Odd," he repeated. He turned away from the window. "We started with only 30, the men in my immediate command. I expected I would draw some of my own kinfolk, since I am high-ranked in the clan. But the others..." Holkar shook his head. "I do not think it's strange at all, my friend." He reached out his hand and tapped his finger on Kungus's chest. It was like tapping a cuirass. "The Buddha's teachings still lurk there somewhere inside your skeptical soul."
Kungus's lips quirked just a bit.
"I doubt that, Dadaji. What good did the Buddha do us when the Yetai ravaged Peshawar? Where was he when Malwa fit us with the yoke?" "Still there," replied the Peshwa. "You disbelieve? Think more about those Kushans who have come from other clans. What brought them here, Kungus?" The Kushan looked away. Holkar drove on. "I will tell you, you skeptic. Memory brought them here. The memory of Peshawar, and Bagram, and Alvarzin, and Khalchayan, and all the other great cities of the Kushan realm. the memory of Emperor Vima and his gigantic irrigation works, which turned the desert green. The memory of Kanishka the Great, who spread Buddhism through half of Asia. Kungus shook his head. Ah, gone, all gone. It is the nature of things. They come, they go. Dadaji took Kungus by the arm and began leading him out of the blood-soaked, fly-infested room. Yes, they do. And then they come back. Or at least their children, inspired by ancient memory. Irritably, Kungus twitched off Hulker's hand. They were in the narrow corridor now, heading for the rickety stairs leading to the street below. Enough of this foolishness, he commanded. I'm a man who lives in the present and as much of the future as I can hope to see, which is not much. Tell me more of Rao's plan for Deagiri. If he takes the city, he cannot hold it alone for more than a year. Not even Deagiri is that great a fortress. Not against the siege cannons which Venandakatra will bring to bear. He will need reinforcement. And then we will need somehow to maintain a supply route. How? And we will need to get cannons of our own. How? From the Romans? He stopped from one step to the next and gave Hulker a sharp glance. They have their own problems to deal with. Belisarius will be marching into Persia soon, you know that as well as I do. That will help, of course, help greatly. The Malwa will not be able to release forces from their Persian campaign, not with Belisarius at their front. But Venandakatra still has a powerful army of his own in the Deccan. He strode on, almost stamping down the stairs. Over his shoulder. So tell me, philosopher, how will we get the cannons? Dadaji did not reply until both men were out on the street. He took a deep breath, cleansing the stench of death out of his nostrils. Then said, still smiling, some of them we will steal from the Malwa. As for the rest, Belisarius will provide. Kungus's brow lowered slightly. On another man, that would have been a fierce scowl. He is thousands of miles away, Dadaji. Hulker's smile was positively serene now. For an instant, Kungus was reminded of a statue of the Buddha. He will provide, skeptic. Trust me in this. Belisarius set this rebellion of ours in motion in the first place. He hasn't forgotten us. Be sure of it. Kungus made his little version of a shrug and strode off behind the diminishing figure of his empress. Hulker remained behind, staring after him. Trust me in this, my friend, he whispered. Of five things in this world, I am certain. Malwa will fall. My empress will restore Andhra. Peshawar will rise again. Belisarius will not fail us. And I... His eyes teared. He couldn't speak the words. I will find my wife and children. Wherever the Malwa beasts have scattered them, I will find them.
Chapter 6. I will not take Morris with me to Egypt, Belisarius. Absolutely not, so stop pestering me about it. And stop pestering me about Valentinian and Anastasius. I refuse to take them either.
Belisarius stared at his wife for a moment before blowing out his cheeks. He leaned back in his chair and glared at Antonina.
You don't understand the danger, woman. You need the best military advisor in the world and the best bodyguards.
Seeing the set and stubborn expression on his wife's face and the way she clasped her hands firmly on the table between them, Belisarius cast a furious glare about the salon. His hot eyes scanned the mosaics which decorated the walls of their small palace within the imperial complex without really seeing them. The gaze did, however, linger for a moment on a small statue perched on a corner stand.
Damn cherub, he growled. What's that naked little wretch smirking about?
Antonina tried to fight down a smile. Her struggle was unsuccessful, however, and the sight of her quirking lips only added to her husband's outrage. Belisarius grit his teeth and twisted in his chair, swiveling his head to the right.
Sit down, Morris, he commanded. Damn you and your stiff ways. I promoted you, remember? You're a general yourself now, a Kiliarch, no less.
Belisarius made a curt motion with his hand as if to sweep Morris forward.
So sit down.
The commander of Belisarius' personal retinue of Bucellarii shrugged, stepped forward, and pulled up a chair. As soon as he took his seat at the table, Belisarius leaned toward him and said, "Explain it to her, Morris. She won't listen to me because she thinks I'm just being a fretful husband, but she'll listen to you." Morris shook his head. "No." Belisarius' eyes widened. "No?" His eyes bulged. "No?" His next words were not entirely coherent. Morris grinned at Antonina. "Never actually seen him gobble before. Have you?" Antonina matched his grin. "Oh, any number of times." The grin began a demure smirk.
"Intimate circumstances, you understand?"
Morris nodded sagely.
"Of course. Dancing naked on his chest, that sort of thing.
Not to mention the whip and the iced..."
"Enough!" roared Belisarius. He slammed his fist on the table. Antonina and Morris peered at him with identical quizzical expressions, much like two owls might study a bellowing mouse.
"He usually does that much better, I seem to recall," mused Antonina.
"Much better,"
agreed Morris.
"The key is understatement, the sense of steel under the soft voice."
Belisarius began to roar again, but seeing the widening grins, managed to bring himself under control.
"Why not?" he demanded through clenched teeth.
Morris's grin faded. The grizzled veteran stroked his stiff, curly gray beard.
"I won't do it," he replied, "because she's right and you're wrong. You are thinking like a fretful husband instead of a general."
He waved down Belisarius's protest.
"She doesn't need me because she's not going to be fighting pitched battles on the open field against vastly superior forces. You are."
Antonina nodded.
Again, Belisarius began to protest. Again, Morris drove him down.
"Besides, you'll have Ashot. That stubby little Armenian may not have quite as much battlefield experience as I do, but he's not far short of the mark. You know that as well as I do. He's certainly got the experience to handle whatever Antonina will run up against in Alexandria."
"But..."
"Oh, be quiet, young man," snapped Morris.
For just an instant, the Kiliarch's stony face reverted to an expression he had not worn in years. Not since the days he had taken under his wing a precocious teenage officer fresh from his father's little estate in Thrace and taught him the trade of war.
"Have you already forgotten your own battle plan?"
Belisarius sat back. Morris snorted.
"Thought so. Since when do you subordinate strategy to tactics, young man? Alexandria is just a step on the road. Your whole strategy against the Malwa pivots on sea power. While you distract them in Persia, Antonina will lead a flanking attack against the enemy's logistics in alliance, we hope, with the Kingdom of Aksum. The Ethiopians, with their naval power, are critical to that plan. For that matter, the Aksumite navy will be essential for providing support to the rebellion in Maharashtra, which you did everything in your power to foment while you were in India. They'll need cannons, gunpowder, everything you've talked about supplying them. That's why you've always insisted on building our armaments industry in Alexandria, so we can provide logistical support for the Ethiopians and the Indian rebellion."
The Kiliarch took a deep breath.
"For all those reasons, Ashot is far better suited to serve as her advisor than I am. The man's a former seaman, but I know about boats."
He snapped his fingers.
"Not to mention the Ethiopians," he rolled on. "Ashot's familiar with them, even speaks the language. I know exactly two words in Ge'ez: beer and the future subjunctive tense of the verb to copulate. That'll be useful, coordinating an allied naval campaign in a transoceanic logistics route."
Belisarius slumped into his chair.
"All right," he said sourly. "But I still insist that she take Valentinian and Anastasius. They're the best fighters we've got. She'll need the protection that they can..."
"For what?"
demanded Morris. He planted his thick hands on his knees and leaned forward. For a moment, he and Belisarius matched glares. Then Morris's lips quirked. He cocked an eye at the little Egyptian woman sitting across the table.
"Are you planning to lead any cavalry charges, girl?"
Antonina giggled.
"Furious boarding parties storming across the decks of ships?"
Giggle, giggle.
leading the troops scaling the walls of a town under siege.
Giggle, giggle, giggle.
Cut and thrust, hack and hew.
The giggles erupted into outright laughter.
Actually, choked Antonina, I was thinking more along the lines of guiding from the rear, you know, ladylike.
She leaned back, arching her neck haughtily, and began pointing with an imperious finger.
You there, that way, and you, over there. Move smartly, do you hear?
Belisarius rubbed his face.
It's not that simple, Morris, and you know it, even if Antonina doesn't.
For a moment, the old crooked smile came back. A feeble travesty of it, rather.
Aren't you the one who taught me the law of battle? Everything gets fucked up as soon as the enemy arrives?
That's why
he's called the enemy, concluded Morris.
The veteran shook his head.
That's not the point, Belisarius. It may well happen, despite our plans, that Antonina finds herself swept up in the fray. So be it. She'll still have hundreds of Thracian Bucellarii protecting her, each and every one of whom, as you damn well know, will lay down his life for her if need be. None of them may be quite as murderous as Valentinian or Anastasius, but they're still the best soldiers in the world, in my humble opinion. If they can't protect her, Valentinian and Anastasius won't make the difference. Whereas, he snarled, the two of them might very well make the difference for you. Because unlike Antonina, you will be leading cavalry charges and hacking and hewing way more than any respectable general has any business doing.
Glare.
As you well know.
Morris stared at Belisarius in silence. The general slouched further down in his chair.
Further. Further.
Never actually seen him pout before, mused the Kiliarch.
Again he cocked his eye at Antonina.
Have you?
Oh, certainly, piped the little woman. Any number of times. Intimate circumstances, of course. When I have a headache and refuse to smear olive oil all over his...
Enough, whined Belisarius.
Antonina and Morris peered at him with identical quizzical expressions, much like two mice might study a whimpering piece of cheese. Several hours later, Belisarius was in a more philosophical mood.
I suppose it'll work out all right in the end, he said almost complacently.
Antonina levered herself up on her elbow and smiled down at her husband.
Feeling less anxiety-ridden, are we?
Belisarius stretched out his legs and clasped his hands behind his head.
Now that I've had more time to think about it, he allowed graciously, I've decided that perhaps Morris was...
Liar, laughed Antonina, slapping his arm.
You haven't been doing any thinking at all since we came to bed, other than figuring out new and bizarre positions from which to stick your...
Don't be coarse, woman, grunted Belisarius.
Besides, I didn't hear you complaining. Rather the opposite, judging from the noises you were making.
You didn't hear me claim that I was enjoying the metaphysics of the Enterprise either.
She sprawled flat on the bed, aping her husband's pose, hands clasped behind her head, legs stretched out.
I say, she pontificated, now that I've had a bit of time to ponder the question in between getting fucked silly, I've come to the conclusion that perhaps that uncouth Morris fellow may have raised the odd valid point here and there.
Belisarius eyed his wife's naked body, glistening with sweat. Antonina smiled seraphically. She took a deep breath, swelling her heavy breasts, then languidly spread her legs.
Ontologically speaking, of course, she continued, the man's daft. But the past several hours of epistemological discourse have led me to the tentative conclusion that perhaps...
She spread her legs wider, took another deep breath.
Some of the fellow's more Socratic excogitations may have elucidated aspects of the purely phenomenological ramifications of...
Belisarius discarded all complacency. Antonina stopped talking then, though she was by no means silent.
Sometime later, she murmured, Yes, all anxieties seem to be gone.
That's because my brains are gone, came her husband's sleepy reply. Fucked right out of my head.
In the morning, Phocius made an entrance into his parents' sleeping chamber and perched himself upon their bed.
Despite the many other changes in his life, the boy insisted on maintaining this precious daily ritual, a pox on imperial protocol and decorum. The gaggle of servants and bodyguards who now followed the young emperor everywhere remained outside in the corridor. The servants thought the entire situation was grotesque and quite demeaning to their august status as imperial valets and maids, but they maintained a discreet silence. The bodyguards were members of the general's Thracian Bucellarii, led by a young cataphract named Julian. Julian had been assigned the task of serving as Phocius's chief bodyguard for two reasons. First, he was married to Hypatia, the young woman who had been Phocius's nanny for years, and still was, though she now bore the resplendent title of imperial governess. Second, for all his youth and cheerful temperament, Julian was a very tough soldier. Julian and the men under his command had made quite clear upon assuming their new duties that they weren't even remotely interested in listening to the complaints of menials. So, while Phocius enjoyed his private moment with his parents, his bodyguards chatted amiably in the corridor outside and his servants nursed their injured pride. Phocius's stay in his parents' bedroom was longer than usual. His stepfather was leaving that day to begin his new campaign in Mesopotamia. Phocius no longer felt the same dread of that prospective absence that he once had. The boy's confidence in Belisarius's ability to overcome all obstacles and perils was now positively sublime. But he would miss him, deeply. More deeply now, perhaps, than ever before. Eventually, however, he emerged. A new sense of duty had fallen on the boy's little shoulders, and he knew that his stepfather had many responsibilities of his own that day. "All right," he sighed after closing the door behind him. "Let's go. What's first?" Julian grinned down at him. "Your tutor in rhetoric insists that you must see him at once. Something to do with tropes, I believe. He says your slackness in mastering synecdoche has become a public scandal." Glumly, Phocius began trudging down the